begin. For those of you who I haven't met yet, my name is Rick Dunning. I'm the museum curator. And this weekend, enthralled absorber of stories. I've enjoyed talking to many of you very much and look forward to more conversations. We thought perhaps this afternoon session would be slightly more formalized version of all the remembering and storytelling that's been going on all over the place and even on the boat on the way up. In part, and I'll admit this right up front, in part so we can catch some of these stories on our tape recording machinery and preserve them that way for future villagers to listen to. And I must confess that I'm at a loss exactly how to start this sort of process going, except maybe to begin with to kind of let all of us see visually the different kinds of folks we have represented within the reunion group. How many of you were actually involved in working in the mine or the mill or the operation one way or another? How many were actually working in the village in some capacity? Okay. Huh? Yeah. And wives of the workers? No. And
I had one wife apiece.
Is that about it? How many were here as children and experienced at least part of their growing up years here in the village? Okay, so we've got some of our groups well represented.
There's still our seats over here.
Yeah, we've got some room over in the far corner, please. I guess one question I'll start the process with, and I hope that perhaps just as we go along it will snowball and stories will bring other stories to mind, and feel free to jump in as things pop into your mind. But one thing I guess from my standpoint, as you come back into the village now, all these years later, what's the most vivid memory that sort of pops in your mind as you first come into the village, your strongest memory of what this place was like for you when you lived here? And maybe
mountains.
With
mountains.
Yeah. Okay.
Snow.
Uh-huh. Anything particularly about the mountains and the snow?
Well, the amount of snow and the way it gently fell, and I always liked it when the snow came back in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so peaceful.
Yes, it was so peaceful, and it seemed to quiet everything. There was always a noise from the mine, and when the snow started, when the snow fell, it was just so very quiet.
I think most people are interested in where they used to live.
Yeah.
We saw a lot of that today.
Sure.
There are a couple of impressions that were for me, and that is how nearly the same the campsite is, and what a horrible wreck there is of the mill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, that makes you shudder.
Yeah,
I agree with that. I think it's amazing the way that the village has maintained and kept the town site here the same. It's just like you go back 50 years when you come in on that bus and you look and see the town site, it hasn't changed.
It's smaller.
Smaller?
Did you live on here when you were smaller?
Yeah. Smaller.
I'll start another try.
Please, yeah.
I think the thing that probably impresses me the most is, although the beauty is there, there's no question of that, and the quietness of the area, comfort, but I'd like to change my thoughts on people. It's the friendliness of the people today that we work with, the stories that are exchanged as we get to talking, and when one thing sparks another thing. If we did over here, and my wife, I came here in 37 and my wife came here in 38, and we've always had a real good group of people working here, people that were dedicated, that loved what they were doing, enjoyed each other. It was an innovative group. We collectively developed methods in mining and milling that, well, the requests for the information came worldwide. We did become the leaders in new ideas. And these new ideas were developed by the people working here. It came from the workers that were in the mine or in the mill, from the engineering, from the operating staff. These ideas were all collected together and brought in methods that prolonged the life of the mine. If we hadn't come up with those ideas, it would have been a good chance that the mine would have shut down much earlier than it did. But it's so heartwarming for me to come back and meet people that we work with. And the, like I say, the friendliness we had for each other.
Mm-hmm. For the tape, give me your name.
My name is John Bly, and I graduated from Washington State College, which was a college then, the university of the day, as a mining engineer, and I came in and worked underground as a common laborer, I guess you'd call it, and went from there, learned it from the ground up, which I never regretted.
That's really literal. He was underground.
But there's a few thoughts you can chew on. Yeah. Maybe I'm hoping that others can expand on it.
I hope so too.
You were talking about the anecdotes that might snowball. Well, I've got one in that one,
please.
A fairly short one. I'm Larry Penberthy. When I was up here, I was a mill sampler. And you know where the assay office is now, the building then was a good deal smaller and not nearly as fine. The mill sampler's assay desk and little tiny cubby hole was facing uphill. The assay office is coming out from the mill's here. And then uphill is where my workbench was, my desk. And there's a hood there and the sample bottles, and I was doing colorimetric assays. One spring, still lots of snow around, some rocks started rattling against my window, and then one of them pushed in, and at the same time I was going out. And then it turned out to be a landslide, a ice mud slide.
Oh my goodness.
It was raining and it loosened up, and then my workplace was filled that full of mud and ice.
Oh my gosh.
And the shifter, Glenn Musty, I think he was the one on at the time, we looked out and he's just by chance, he said, "You never saw me move so fast."
Be some incentive.
Mr. Shipman, I'll never forget Ted Miller and myself. We watched the Gamblers and never played cards or nothing much, but once in a while we'd flip a coin with the boys. And so Ted, he come up with making a double-headed penny. So, Verb Shipman, he works at the SAI, I worked up there. So I'll help myself some nitric acid. So I brought this bottle of nitric acid down. I worked 20 shifts. I got right to the end of the barracks there and fell down. I broke the bottle of nitric acid. Well, the lady lived in the top, and we lived in the bottom. And I'm undoing my belt by the time I get to the end of the stairwell. My pocket dropped off. And I'm holding everything away from my back end. I sit on the bottle immediately getting in the water. If I had been up on the bridge, crossing the bridge up there and fell, I think I would have went in the river. And it was the middle of winter, but that was so hot. I stayed in there half an hour, 45 minutes, and went into my room and I got a mirror. And I looked and I guess I better go wake Doc up. I went up and he just chuckled. He said, "That goes to show you, you don't take things."
That's Bible study, isn't it?
All you familiar with what a stope is? It's an opening in an ore body where the ore is extracted and goes through a great way to shoot. I was responsible for a crew on the 550 level, and we were beginning to undercut these areas in preparation so we could break major ore portions by water blasting. I'd gone to lunch, and I came back to check on the crew. I couldn't find them. I went through each of the other openings. There were about six of them along the level. I went through five of them. Here the whole crew was in the sixth one, up in the stove with shovels. And they were throwing muck all over the place. And I saw one man sitting over in the corner, kind of grinning. And I figured he had done something. So I told the crew, "I don't know what you're doing here, but you better get back where you belong." And they left and went back to their respective workplaces. Then I went over to this grinning miner and I said, "Just what did you do?" "Well," he said, he told me, he said, "You're going to find out sooner or later, so I might as well tell you now. I'll take the chance on being fired." It says in the lunchroom, I just casually remarked that I found some free gold up there in the stove, and they all went up there to... if you're familiar with our ore body, the gold doesn't stick out like that. It's sometimes even difficult to find it under a microscope. But I didn't fire the guy. The trouble is, he was a pretty good miner.
Linda?
I'd like to share another people story, because John talked about how wonderful the people are. That wasn't just in terms of the mine, but the community as a whole. This is from the 50s, but my father died of a heart attack up here in 1955. And the support that our family got from the community was really tremendous. And in that summer, my mother moved because, of course, you can't stay up here with your child and got all your kids out to high school. And the day that she was moving, two of her brothers brought a truck in, and they brought it up to the house. And about the time they were backing the truck to the house, there were quite a few neighbors there to help her, but she heard this whooping and hollering. And here coming, marching up the road, was a group of about 12 men from the dorms, the single guys that lived in the dormitories, case of air under a couple of arms. And my mother never lifted one stick of furniture that day. Her entire truck and everything was packed and moved and loaded for her. And they did such a great job that when we unloaded the truck in Marysville, about three quarters of the way up in the truck was a half a bottle of unspilled beer.
That's great.
I have one similar to that, the trainers. The number, you know. I'm sure I knew the Paul trainer, Gus trainer. Well, I married one of the trainer girl. I never knew Paul trainer. Teresa, Mary's daddy, Bernie trainer's daddy. But he was a fine man, I'm sure of that. He had some fine children. Well, anyway, my wife read in the post office that her daddy died in Wenatchee. He got pleurisy. She went in the post office to get the mail. Bernie had been down to Wenatchee with his mother and told about, come home and told that Dad's supposed to come home tomorrow. And here, Tracy goes in the post office and reads that he passed away. The whole group of people up here, like John says, got together, moved Mrs. Trainer out, packed all her stuff and helped him get out. And all she had is a little old home, $1,200, I think she sold that home for. And she raised the children. Did a fine job of it. I want to thank you all for taking to our party.
I have one funny thing. My name's Chuck Reniker, and I came here as a child in 1937 and left when I got out of eighth grade in 1942. And we lived in converted dormitories up to the old Winston camp to later one my dad built in the new Winston camp. But all through the years when I got my cuts and bruises and broken noses from bicycle wrecks and whatnot, I would go to the hospital and they would patch me up and send me back out again. In 1942, when we left the mine, about 6 months later, Dad got a bill from the hospital here. And it had my history of my childhood. My childhood cost my dad
$16.50. I'll take one on. Some of these people's gray headed may have been the teenagers that did this to me. We lived up there next to us. And just past us, there was quite a grave there that somebody would doze the snow off of the street. And down the street, you know, the town walked up there. And these kids started their sleds up here and went down there and go up the exit. So that was pretty nice the way they were doing that. So they invited me to get on it and ride the sled down. So I did. Well, when I hit the bottom and started up the other side, the sled stopped. I went on and my belt buckle turned this way and I scooped my pants from the father and caught me here and filled my shirt. And I was a mess and trying to hang from that sled when it turned me loose. Well, I tore a thumb pretty good and I couldn't figure out why in the world having those kids is doing all right. But then I discovered they had dug a booby trap. It was square, just a little wider than the sled. It was a square up in. So, and it was a moonlight night, and so they could see that, but I couldn't. I didn't know it was there. So I come down and I hit that square in the center, and that sled.
This isn't the funny category, but when I came up here in 38, there were 17 college graduates working underground, bucking or mining. And this apparently was quite a training camp for engineers, because later on I went to the Bureau of Mines in Spokane, and I traveled a lot in the Western United States. And every place we went, oh, that guy was from Holden. That guy was from Holden. And the fellow I was traveling with, he said, everybody, every engineer in the world work up there at Holden? There was someone John Benchy in Minnesota, there was Colonel Sackett down someplace else, there was somebody else someplace else. Every place we went seemed like there was an engineer that had been worked at his home. And there was not room for everybody up here. And they had to go out, you know, to get any place that they did.
Are any of the Rogers here?
There must be.
Should we have Rogers? There's one.
Yeah. Wait a minute.
Yeah, right here. One of the twins.
Can I tell a story about your dad?
Sure.
Well, this got funny in a way. But I was down here in the town site and I heard a large explosion. And I thought that was kind of odd. And it came from the direction of Winston. And I thought, well, I better get up there and see what's going on. So I got up there, and here's the Roger home, the smoke coming out of it. And what had happened, Roger wanted to blast a rock in his basement, and he didn't judge the charge too well. By the time that everything had taken apart, the vacuum cleaner stuck up in the ceiling of the third floor. smashed a lot of Mrs. Rogers' beautiful dishes, pickle jars too. And by the time I got there, he was getting quite a lecture from his wife. pretty sheepish about it. Well, then when I came along there and he saw me, that didn't help me. And I said, well, what happened to you? Well, then he told me, and I said, well, by the way, where did you get the dynamite? Well, my lunch bucket was empty, so I put some of it in my lunch bucket. Well, you said, you know that's a no-no. Yeah, I know that's a no-no. And I said, well, if it weren't for all the kids that you've got here, and your wife already being upset, I'd fire you on the spot. I said, I really don't have the heart to put the penalty on your family. So he stayed on the payroll.
You remember that?
Yes.
Yeah, I do.
That's the truth, too.
Boy, absolutely, every bit of it. For my mother, pardon the language, but when we did the set off the glass, Dad had dinner, and Ed Miles, Sr., I helped my dad. We sat there and all day drilling a hole in that rock, and then he put a sack of wet sand on top of it. They got the dynamite in it. And that's what went up through the floor. We had dinner for the Miles and everything. And his mother said, D.A., before you set that off, says, no, let me clean up the kitchen and set these pickles that she can off on the, get them out of the way. Oh, hell, excuse my language, because my father was pretty used to the language. And he said, don't worry about it, nothing's going to happen. So we went all down on the street, that blast went off. So Dad and I and my twin brother and all, we went under the house to see how it did with the rock. And my mother went right up in the house, and the next thing we heard, E.A. That's when she really started reading on the rock. One thing about it did get the rock going. The rock was probably, it was such a big rock, we couldn't move it. So that's the reason Dad figured out, well, we'll glass the thing out. But it did work. We got it out of there.
I bought a house up here from Rango in 49. And it had a big rock in the basement, too. And I wanted to put an apartment down there. So Carl Sprague, who lived across the street from me, he says, I never heard this about Rogers before, but he said, Go ask Rogers. Down on the street the next morning, you know, I made it down on the street. Start screaming, I don't even say, I got big bones in my basement. Too big to dig up on water, I said, will you shoot it for me? Hell no!
I got something that's a little in a little different vein that makes Holden a little different than other places. Just about 40 years ago, at this time of the year, it was either the end of September or the 1st of October, this next dorm up here, a guy shot and killed a yearling black bear from the upper deck. It wandered down the road into the camp. And so he went and got his high-powered rifle and dispatched it right there in the street. So naturally, a lot of us heard it, and we went up to see what happened. That doesn't happen too many places. That was 1952.
I got one to follow on the gold story that you had. I learned from one of the assayers that gold, finely divided gold, will collect in the little twigs and bits of wood pulp on the side of the float cells. And so I thought that was pretty interesting, so I scooped out a cup full of that and gave it to the fire assayer, and he burned it down, and then he went through the steps and he produced a little tiny bead of gold and gave it to me. I didn't think anything about it. That's not high grading, I wouldn't think. And so I was sitting up there on the ledge above the dining hall, and Victor Apollo Zanadvorov, the metallurgist for whom I worked, he came out of the dining room and came over to me, and he says, "You have spoiled all the assays," and turned around. He said, "See me in my office." Well, I was coming on shift at 3 o'clock, and I got up there, and he gave me a pretty tough time for a while. Then I found out the next day from Oscar Wickham, who was one of the float operators, he says, "You didn't solve anything. There wasn't any. You didn't have anywhere enough. The mine had hit a gold pocket. It wasn't rich, but it sure influenced all the assays all the way through the mine in a way." I was off the book then.
I don't know where that pocket of gold was.
I'm not going to tell you. Be up there with a shovel.
Another childhood memory with you. I don't know how many people remember that when we were here in the 50s, they used to have a bazaar every fall. The ladies' hospital here was raised lots of money for both the Schwann Hospital and the Children's Orthopedic Hospital in Seattle. And one year in the 50s, they raffled off a toboggan. And all of us kids saved and spent every bit of our babysitting money buying tickets on that toboggan. And there was a couple in camp that had no children, and the lady's nickname was Duly Earned, and that toboggan was won that year by a lady named Chubby Merrill. All of us kids had spent all our money, and she took the toboggan out the door, and I know if she got on it, it would have never gone anywhere, because her nickname was Well Earned. What did she do? I don't know what she did.
I can tell you a bear story. Kurt Bell had it in his paper here. Bob Booth the bear hunter. Well, I took my wife and my two children with me one day. We went up bear hunting. We got up the hill, up the foot of the hill up there. I forget what they call it. It's one of the hills that goes up around. It's got a pathway that goes up around the Salmonberries. All bushes all along the side. We got up to the foot of that, and there's a picnic table there, so we decided we'd have our lunch there. The wind was blowing pretty. We're sitting there and all of us heard some rocks rolling, you know. But in the meantime, going up, well, I met that, I can't remember his name. It was one of the miners, and him and his wife was coming down, and they had a horse, and they had a bear skinned out. They had that meat on the horse, and I said, "Where'd you get your bear?" We said, "Got over there in the meadow, so to the left over in the meadow, they got me a little bear over there, you know." So I said, "Well, you probably scared him out of there." I said, "We're going up here on the high ground." So we sitting there having our lunch, and wind was blowing pretty good. And all at once, I heard some rocks rattling. My wife says, "What's that?" And I said, "Maybe it's a horse or something up there." And then they're out again. And then I said, "Maybe it's a bear or rolling, turning some rocks looking for grubs or something." I said, "I'll go up and see." So you and the kids stay here. So I took up the trail. Just as you get to the top of the hill, there's a little raise like that, and it's dipped down real sharp. Well, he'd taken a piece of log, I don't know where he got it from, anyway, there's a log there, and he took the bear skin and dropped it over the log. I stepped around, there's a little turn there to come into it. I stepped around and here's the bear. I didn't even have time to show him a gun. I thought I could have. I knew when that second bullet hit it, I knew something was wrong. Why didn't kids come around and said, "Get him, Daddy?" And I showed him and I hit him so hard he knocked the hide in his head. Of course, Ben had a big piece in the paper about that. He published some paper up there. He had a piece of paper about Boots the Bear Hunter. I still have it. Why don't I tell you nothing about it? We're building a pretty good sized boat up that here, and he built it in his basement. He got it all built, a nice looking boat. And then he said, "You know," he said, "I don't know, I was going to get that out of here." He said, "I was driving my house out." And he did, he had to catch the boat to the whole north side of his house.
You're talking about bear stories. Here's a deer story for you. How many of you remember Dean Allison? He's a pretty good hunter. He and his dad together, they were a bear. But anyway, Dean went up behind Holden Lake and he got his deer. He was dragging it down and got down to the trail and was heading for home when he ran into the game warden. Well, it so happened when he shot the deer, he shot the horns off of it. He had already cleaned it. And he couldn't prove to the game warden that it was a male deer. He says, "By golly, I'll prove it to you. I'll go get those horns. But I won't go up today, I'll go back up tomorrow." So he went back up where he shot the deer and actually found the horns and brought them down to the guy. Now that's a story he told me, you can take it from there.
I have one more deer story. This is a bad one. My grandfather lived for about a year or so in a log cabin that was across the creek from the ballpark. And you had to wind your way across over there on logs, across that swampy ground. And next to the cabin, there was a mine portal. Probably Holden put it there years and years ago. But he used that portal to hang meat in. One year he got a deer and he hung the meat in there during the winter.
Well, in the spring, he still had a little bit of that deer left, but unfortunately, a piece of it had spoiled. And this is like 1937 or 8, something like that. And the game warden found that spoiled meat, gave him a ticket, cost him $100. And he wrote blood money across the check when he gave it to him.
You know, you've heard about bears, and actually, there were quite a few bears around at that time. And the miners got in the habit of making an extra peanut butter and honey sandwich. And when they used to come out of the mine and sit around the fire out at the portals and have their lunch. And invariably the bear knew this too. So he fed this peanut butter sandwich and honey. And I think there were bears putting there on every portal. So one night, it was about 11:30, I was coming out of the mine on the 1500 level. And about 1500 feet from the portal, I could see a big hump out there. Right in the middle of the track. Well, the closer I got, then I began to realize what it was. Here's a bear sitting right in the middle of the track looking in the portal. And I had to find a way to get out of there. Well, I'd gotten pretty cold mining that day, and I didn't eat my peanut butter sandwich. When I got close enough, I sailed that peanut butter sandwich over his head, and he went after the sandwich and I headed for the dry.
Cinnamon bear up there.
Yeah, Dean Allison's cinnamon bear.
Sure, our nice cinnamon bear.
Well, that was the story. You going ahead with it there? That's a good one.
I don't know. Oh, I know it.
Well, there was a bear at one of the levels. I think it was the 550. It really became a pet of everybody's, and everybody was feeding it. Well, unfortunately, that bear met a bullet that fall. And the story went around that the one hunter held the sandwich while the other guy shot it. But I question whether that story is true. Because these two characters would instigate things like that anyway. But they got the Dickens anyway about shooting the pet bear.
Yeah.
I think Dean Allison got the rug.
He got the rug, yeah.
You remember the pet bear cub they had at Paul Winston Camp? They had a cub.
Back when Elizabeth Taylor was here?
No. This was back in like 38, 37. Oh, uh-huh. They had a cub up there and they had a big barrel and the cub slept in the barrel, maybe. Yeah. So we kept it.
Yeah, we had an albino bear up here. Yeah. And everybody and his little brother tried to get that one. And the Luce brothers were hunting up at Holden Lake and they saw this albino up on the mountainside. They thought, well, that would be a trophy. So they started up the mountain. And the bear would sit up there and watch them. When they got within rifle range, the bear moved back 50 feet. And they never did catch up with it. That bear just kept moving back. And to this day, I don't know whether anybody ever got that bear. I never did hear whether anybody got it.
You know, them deer and bears getting to read them game books, I swear.
Yeah,
I've shot 37 deer and hunted elk 14 or 15 years and never shot an elk. And went bear or grouse hunting one year with a shotgun and I have a little cocker spaniel and I have him out there and he's doing a pretty good job. All along with that little cocker spaniel, he's in front of me and hugging my feet and tripping me. And so I put him heels in behind me there and I'm walking along. And the little trail, this is on the coast now. All at once I see a bear and that bear up from here to the wall there. And so I'm killing birdshot this close, I figure. He looked like he was from here to these plants. But I looked around behind me and I picked myself out a tree to run up and I figured I'd crawl up that quick enough. I proceeded to get him behind the ear and I pulled the trigger and Man, oh man. I no more than pulled a trigger and a cub went up a tree and another cub went another way and Shipman, he went the other way. I didn't get from here to them plants and my dog tripped me and luckily the female, she ran the other way too. She let a blat out of her and I never did go back to see if I drawed any blood. Too much fear there.
We had a, get back to the mine. Maybe we go into the mine and do a little bit more talking there, but in this particular instance, we had a Mexican working for us, and he got into an argument with the union president in his room. This was about 2 o'clock in the morning. Well, at any rate, he ended up at my home, screaming and jumping up and down on the porch, and I let him in, and I sat him down, and I said, well, now, what's all this about? Well, he says, so-and-so was in my room and he wouldn't leave and I wanted to go to bed. I came off shift at 11:30 and I wanted to get some rest. He wouldn't leave. So I said, he got his guitar out, he got a hold of the handle end of it, and he says, I hit him over the head with it and the guitar fell all apart. And I looked him over on one side or the other and he said, there wasn't any blood. So he said, I hit him with what I had left. And he says, still no blood. And he said, then I hit him a third time and still no blood. And he says, here I am. I said, well, what's the problem? He said, well, he won't get out of my room. And I said, well, I think if you go back and he'll be gone, maybe he isn't, then come back and tell me and I'll go down with you. Okay, so he left. Well, I didn't think anything more about it. Then our president of our company came in for his usual inspection of gold and mine. And I got to talking to him, and I mentioned this incident. He says, well, you know what was wrong. I said, no. He says, that Mexican was disgraced. He couldn't draw blood. And that hurt his feelings. Because he lost his manhood. But then the union president got up at the next union meeting. He says, one of our brothers has had a grievous loss, and I think we should make a collection. We'll buy him a new guitar. And somebody happened to know the story, and he said, yes, that's a very good idea, and I think you're the one that has the money that it should pay for it. But this Mexican was, we had an awful time finding a place that he loved to work. And finally we got the idea and we put him on that big jaw crusher underground. And he became a changed person. He loved the size of that and it made him feel important. And he got a big kick out of taking care of that. I'm telling you, that room was slick. There was no grease around anywhere and he took care of that machinery and he was as happy as a lark. So sometimes if you keep working at it, you finally find a spot for some of these people.
But there's three of them brothers.
Beg pardon?
Three of them brothers.
Mexican
brothers.
I don't remember that he had a brother. His name was Garcia.
Oh, no.
And I never knew what happened to him. He left finally. I think he went south because it was too cold, too much snow up here.
Oh, that brings up a snow story. I suppose there are a lot of those up here, but the winter I was here, 51-52, we had a lot of snow. It seems to me like it was something like 450 inches that year. And I lived right over in that dorm over there, and at the time they had the electric wires draped between the buildings. I see they've got a more a common one now. At that time there were three wires going. And I woke up one morning to go over to the mess hall for breakfast, and I walked outside and I saw a sight I'd never seen in my life. I looked up those wires and it looked like a newspaper going from the building right over to the mess hall. The snow had fallen with absolutely no breeze, snowflake on snowflake, and it was about that tall. And another time, it was only about 18 inches, but I'd never in my life seen anything like that. And then as soon as the first little warmth of the sun getting against the building, it just moved enough air that stuff would collapse and fall off. But it was a wonderful sight.
Talking about snow, maybe somebody can add to it or subtract from it, but I believe in all the years that we spend up here, there's one person caught in a snowflake. And this man left shift early and started to walk down the road. You know where the old Powder magazine used to be on that road, just below the portal? He got caught in that roadway that had been kept clear by the rotary plow. Apparently whipped him out and whipped him through the trees and went on down, partway down the mountain, down to the next road. And I got a call at 2:30 in the morning that this man had been caught in a snowslide. So I went up, and as I walked up from the base of the snowslide, I found a stocking cap. And we had an old gravel bucket there and the handle there, so I hung the cap on that handle of that gravel bucket and went on up to the drive, and we organized a search crew. Some of the fellows wanted to use a bulldozer. I wouldn't let him because, well, he might be lucky enough that he got caught in an air pocket and might still be all right. But we got 20-foot half-inch rods. I don't know how many of us poked around in the snow, but we started in about 3 o'clock, and 5 o'clock that afternoon we found him. And the irony of it was he was directly under the hat that I'd hung up on that handle. And it was quite obvious that the person was killed instantly. He had no chance at all. But I think that's the only incident I know of all the snowslides we had in the area of anybody ever getting caught in one. They've had some scary times, but they've managed to stay clear of them.
Go ahead.
But Vint and I did something one time too, even though it was rather... Maybe you remember, Vince, we'd been surveying all morning, and it came to noontime, and we thought, well, it's a good time to go down to Honeymoon Heights, and we'll have lunch with our wives. But we came out on the 800 level, and we saw a piece of sheeting there, and we bent the top of it up, and we both sat on this thing, and we were going down the 1100 level. But I think we went by the 1100 level so fast we didn't even see it. I think we got home in time for lunch.
Yeah, even we did a lot of crazy things.
And our little boy's grown tall.
Well, this is a question for someone. I worked at Baldwin's at the mill, and I didn't have anything to do with transport. Can anyone tell how the ore truck stayed on the road on that grade in the wintertime?
Good drivers.
Well, who maintained it? Was it scraped dry and...
No, the company maintained that. They had their rotary snow plows and bulldozers and...
Sanders.
And they kept a good maintenance schedule on all the trucks. I believe... in that time, there's only one truck that got away from somebody.
Jerry Thatch. Jerry Thatch was driving that truck.
One of those bends didn't make. And he came out of it alive. He hit this boulder, apparently, and all three buckets on the truck went right over the cab over the rock. Didn't hurt him. But that's the only incident I know of that. A lot of trips went down there. Well, I don't know of any truck that was caught in a snowslide. They were caught between snowslides. Mm-hmm. But people, I don't know, there were people that were around these things could seem to sense when the area of the snowslide was going to move. And they would start taking precautions.
It seems to me that
there wasn't much snow when you started down the switchback.
The snow was less there than it was up yeah. here, right.
So that may have helped too, yeah. I imagine.
I have a question on that. Did they ever use the railway that went up from the lake to...
I did. When I first came here, that's the only way I could get up to the top of the hill. The road wasn't in yet. And they used that tramway to bring all of the supplies and the people that worked up there. And when you got up at the top, they had the Silver Goose, which was an open stake truck, and you hung onto the stake to get up here. At least that's the truck I had. And it rained all day, and by the time I got up here to what was now Honeymoon Heights, I was soaking wet. I mean, I was wet. And I came in with a fella, Ralph Carlson, and we looked at each other, and we looked at what we got into, and said, well, let's work here long enough that we got enough money to go someplace else. So 15 and a half years later, my wife and I
left.
And two children.
How many here come in here when they run a pack string in here and all equipment in here? And they had the mules, you know, packed a lot of equipment in here. Had a half-brother, George Bagwell, and a brother-in-law, Ted Miller, that helped on that. And I was, they both passed away. I was wondering if anyone here was in on that. None left, huh?
That's too far back for us.
We're all younger.
When you were telling stories about the road, I've told it repeatedly too, and I hope it's true, but I don't remember for sure. But, I remember going down in the winter down the switchbacks, and because you have a lot of snow and snowplow, when it was deep snow, that you felt more secure because you wouldn't go off the lower edge. There was some embankment on that, but my favorite was, I remember being on the bus coming up the hills on the switchbacks, and one of those tight ones where the bus swings out wide. And the doctor was coming down the road about the same time. He was on the wrong side. We were on the wrong side. We just passed this thing by.
Does anybody remember, I'm not sure of this, who the contractor was that put in the middle?
Well, I think Winston Brothers had the master contract.
They had the master contract.
And I think the subcontracts, I don't know who that was, but they did most of the excavation, of course.
Yeah, and they did the town site too, Winston.
Yeah.
Remember.
That was an interesting story, really. On the road up here, that as told me by Harold Sharp, they had come in after they had decided this would become an economic possibility. But the one thing they had to decide was how they're going to get the concentrate out. And the first thought was that they would have a railroad from Lucerne up to here. Of course, up in Britannia Mining and Smelting Company, they had a railroad there for years, probably since 1920 or something like that. So they came out here. The president and Emil Richter, who was the secretary treasurer, and Quigley, who was the president just before Harold Sharp, and they invited Winston to come along with them. And so they traveled the whole distance from Lucerne by foot to kind of decide what the best way to get something up there to carry out the concentrates and supplies in and so forth. And so everybody but Winston apparently decided it was going to be in railroad. But when they got up to here, Winston says, you know, this is no railroad job. This is a truck road. And they decided right then that was it. And they made their economic studies on the basis of truck and railroad. And there was no doubt about that. Of course, it was pretty early in the game, you know. And so that was the final thing, as I understand, that made it economic to come in here at that time and start the serious development on the mine.
Did they lay some track, though?
Pardon me?
Did they lay some track?
No, not that they were.
And that was the ties that were put down, as I understand it, was that due to the Great Northern and Northern Pacific was toying with the idea of barging up their cars and putting them on a railroad to come up along Railroad Creek, and that's supposedly how Railroad Creek got its name, and they're going on over the pass over towards the post.
Sure.
But they soon changed that.
Well, that was Major Rogers who was commissioned to find the route to
the
Cascades. And Holden was with Major Rogers.
That's when he found the ore body.
And then he noticed the oxidation on the hills. When he got to the West Coast Water Report, I think it was the Denny family, that did finance him to do more prospecting and so forth. So finally he got his claims. But of course Major Rogers decided this was going to be too tough to a tunnel in respect and in comparison to the one that they have further south.
I'm reluctant to break this up, but it is almost 5 o'clock.
I have just one more story.
One more story to wrap it up.
I want to see if anybody can talk this. I don't know whether anybody knows Joe Short or not. He used to be the steel sharpener. And one Sunday we had a day off. And if everybody knows what Lucerne was like and what was down there, Joe Short and I hiked all the way to Lucerne to go to the grocery store and get a quart of milk.
Well, it'll hopefully be a little bit of a continuation also in Well, I bet they did. They didn't quite have enough time to get everything out.
Was this session recorded or not? Transcribed and put in the archive.
That's why we had it in this room where we've got the piece of recording equipment captured. Well, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Good damn. Fun session.
We have a couple like this.
I tried to get it back to my
In a way, it's all part of the history of the place.
And there was a couple of guys from the dorms, miners, that went down to Lucerne one time, and they got drunk. And they ran a camp, so they came back up to get some more. And on the way up, they got up to Dan's camp. And they saw two bear cubs. One went over the hill and one went up a tree. So they wanted to get this bear, but they didn't know how, they didn't have a gun or anything. So one of them decided that he'd just sit down at the foot of the tree and wait until the other come up and got a gun and got some more money, so they could go drink some more. And the guy came back from up here and had his money and a gun. There was this other fellow laying on the ground. He passed out. And the cub came down and scratched the devil out.
Oh, dear!
And he never even woke up.
Oh!
Boy, he did pass out. Huh? Oh,
you stay too, man.
Okay.
What are you doing?
We